But again, improve the eighth to ninth grade counts as well as graduation rates. If we can keep this pilot project going with the students that we started with 3 years ago and track them through graduation, we'll have data to be able to prove that. We served 435 students last year, 262 unduplicated students, so there are students who continue to get into trouble, and 208 different incidents were dealt with restorative interventions. And I think that's all I have to share, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
So if I could just summarize, you've had 262 students at the middle school who do something that they would normally get suspended for, and instead you bring them in for counseling and, if necessary, talking with another student if it's an issue with a fight. Is that essentially the program?
Correct. Yeah.
And what do you mean by restorative justice?
Restorative justice essentially relies on asking three questions. What's the harm? Who did the harm? What's the impact of the harm? And how can you repair the harm and avoid doing the harm again in the future? So what our person who is housed at the middle school actually does is walk the kids through those three steps, gets them to think about the consequences of their actions, and get them to talk about how they're going to repair the harm. We're also providing relevant community service opportunities for these kids. So rather than suspension, they actually get to fix whatever it is. And that's really relevant to whatever the incident was.
Great. Well, thank you both for being here. I very much appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you
very much.
Anyone else wish to testify on this matter? Carly, can you please call the vote on this?
Aye.
Well, thanks again for being here. And this is an example. The mayor and I, and in fact the whole council, have been working hard since Friday, and the news broke about a student who had grown up in Portland Public Schools, and people have been asking questions about what do we do to help troubled kids, and this is a great example of what we do to help troubled kids. So thank you, Rob, for your work in the Office of Youth Violence, and Betsy, for your work at Resolutions Northwest. It's also an example. Later on today, we'll be voting on the gun restrictions that Mayor Adams and the police have asked for, and it's an example of what else we're doing to address the whole picture of what's going on in our community. So I greatly appreciate the work that you're doing. Aye.
Saltzman? Thank you for your support.
Yeah, that's very impressive results. Good work. Aye.
Adams?
Thank you. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for item number 1545.
Authorize application to the Department of Human Services Regional Offices on Women's Health for a grant in the amount of $2,500 for activities and events in support of prevention of violence against women and girls.
Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. And this, again, is something that I have on the regular agenda to highlight the work that Commissioner Saltzman is doing with prevention of violence against women and girls, which I'm happy to partner with him on. Amy True in his office and Sarah Hussein in mine have been working together to put in this grant. It's not very large, but it's another action in helping to deal with the issues of human trafficking and domestic violence in our city. Because of our proximity to marine ports, airports, and I-5, and because of the so-called progressive attitude of many of our citizens, our city has become a magnet for human trafficking. And I think it's another reason to have this on the agenda today is it's high time to recognize that prostitution in particular is not usually an action that happens between consenting adults. Over 50% of the victims in our city are children. And so we want to address this not only with some of the measures that the mayor and Commissioner Saltzman are doing in helping the victims and prosecuting those responsible, also by working on prevention. So adding to the problem is a low graduation rate in Portland Public Schools, where in 2009 only 53% of the students graduated on time. Teens that drop out of school are at the highest risk for becoming victims of human trafficking. And domestic violence is also a serious issue affecting not only women but men and children, with incidences in the Portland area increasing dramatically, especially with the recession. According to the Family Violence Coordinating Council, in the last 14 months, almost 50 Oregonians have died as a result of domestic violence, representing a 40% increase over recent years. Law enforcement, along with other government agencies and community organizations, are working together to support and rescue victims of violence and human trafficking. So the need for prevention of this behavior, specifically education to at-risk teens, has never been greater. And that is why my colleague Commissioner Saltzman and I have teamed up for this grant project. Receipt of the grant will allow the city to begin to partner more effectively with community agencies to actively address preventative behaviors of violence against young girls and women and continue our proactive role in eliminating domestic violence and human trafficking. Working with the community, we intend to host a workshop for boys and girls aged 12 to 18 years old, with a focus on preventing violence against women and girls in our community. Our partners include the Portland Police Bureau's Girl Strength Program, Volunteers of America, East Portland Community Coalition Group, and the Sexual Assault Resource Center. I thank everyone who has participated in this thus far in this grant application and hope that we have the opportunity to see this project out. And when we get the grant, which I am very hopeful that we will, we'll have another full presentation. In the meantime, thanks to Commissioner Saltzman, Amy True, and Sarah Hussein, Carolyn Haycraft of the Girl Strength Program, and the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services.
All right. Anyone wish to testify on this matter?
No one signed up.
All right. Please call the vote on this emergency ordinance.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I just want to thank Commissioner Fritz and again, and Sarah Hussein and her office and Amy through my office for working on this grant. I am hopeful we'll get it for all the reasons that Commissioner Fritz has so eloquently articulated. Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Thank you. Good work. So approved. Can you please read the title for second reading? Second reading, item number 1546.
Add new and amend existing city code provisions to address illegal gun use and violent gang activity in the city.
Please call the vote.
Leonard?
I appreciate Mayor Adams bringing this to us. These are amongst the toughest issues, as I spoke to the last time we had a hearing on this subject. It raises a number of emotions for people on both sides of the debate, but his proposal and dedication to seeing it through, I think, is admirable, and I'm pleased to support it. Aye.
Fritz.
I agree. I greatly appreciate Mayor Adams and Chief Reese bringing forward these proposals and indeed the community discussion that happened last week and has been ongoing over the couple of months that's been proposed. Dave Warbrill in the city attorney's office has given us great advice. It's been a very respectful and reasoned discussion, and I think that that's a good thing when sometimes these things are not so. Oregon law allows cities to regulate discharge of firearms and possession of loaded firearms in public places and doesn't prohibit us from enacting curfew laws, reporting loss of firearms, and regulating gun access to children. So these measures have been very carefully crafted to respect state law and respect federal law and the Constitution and still govern the things that we are allowed to regulate. So I appreciate the very careful approach. I agree with a comment that Commissioner Leonard made last week that if these changes can save even one life or turn one life around and get it back on the right track, then we have done something right. I do believe we need to revisit these changes in the next year and determine whether or not they have helped, look at the fees, and I appreciate the clarification from Warren Jimenez in the mayor's office that indeed the 30-day minimum sentence would not apply to minors. So that answered one of the big questions that I had. This is a very complicated issue. Obviously, we have problems in our community where people both young and old are shooting each other, and that's not okay. So we need to try some new things to see if we can get a hold of that. I felt there was some good discussion last week regarding other mechanisms, and as I just alluded to in the previous items, we are doing other things, and I think there was a good suggestion to address the small number of minors convicted of gun crimes with counseling and other mechanisms. So I know we'll work on that too. Thank you, Mayor Adams. Aye.
Fish.
I've received two different kinds of emails on this proposal, Mayor. The first category says essentially that this goes too far, and the second says it doesn't go far enough, which tells me that you have probably crafted sort of the balanced common sense approach as a first step. What is, while there may be a debate about whether it goes too far or not far enough, what's clear and what no one in this council would deny is that we have to do something. I live in Northeast Portland, and I'm frankly tired about reading about shootings and homicides and gang activities throughout Northeast Portland, among other locations in our community. And so we have to do something. And as Commissioner Fritz said, echoing what Commissioner Leonard said last week, if our actions result in one life being saved, then it is a worthwhile endeavor. A big question was made about whether we had the legal authority to do this. Our council has looked at this and told us we do. Fortunately, we have something called the judicial system. And if someone sues us and it turns out that we have to modify this proposal, then an impartial judge will tell us, not an advocate. We'll have, through the legal system, advice as to how to improve and strengthen this proposal. We need to do something. The mayor is right in addressing this with a sense of urgency. This is not a perfect solution, and it doesn't solve the problem. But it's a very important first step, and I think it's an important statement by this council that we want to end this senseless cycle of violence and protect young people in our community. So I proudly support this ordinance. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I do have concerns about state preemption in our ability to regulate issues related to guns. I do believe also that the violence we have been seeing in our community tips in the balance of adopting these ordinances or these code changes. And I think that as 2 weeks ago, many people pointed out, we need to also be investing in people and the success of young people who are caught up in gun violence and gang violence. And I think we have taken steps and will continue to take steps as a city council in that direction. I think in the last year and a half, we have committed $400,000 ongoing to gang outreach activities. And I know that Chief Sizer had secured an additional $200,000 federal grant over 3 years. So I think that we are trying to strike the right balance between ordinances and making sure that we are addressing the needs of young people in our community. So I want to thank Mayor Adams, the Office of Youth Violence Prevention, Warren Jimenez, and also the Portland Police Bureau. Please to vote aye.
Adams.
Well, thank you, members of the City Council, for your encouraging words and for your support of this measure. I also want to thank Chief Reese and the team at the Police Bureau that are doing a fantastic job and have helped craft this ordinance. I want to thank District Attorney Mike Schrunk and his team, who also gave significant input on this ordinance. Dave Warbill, the great Dave Warbill, from the Office of the City Attorney, who advises us on a whole host of matters relating to public safety, and the smart and difficult work of coming up with a set of local laws or local policy changes that breaks what has been almost two decades of legal silence on the regulation of guns and two decades of legislative silence on reducing gun murders and gun injuries, assaults in this city. I want to make sure that those that express concern about this, especially concern about racial profiling, I want them to know that I absolutely share that concern, and so does everyone involved in considering this matter. It is there is a a unique racial aspect to this issue, as we talked about last time, that we cannot, pretend does not exist. Young African-American males are killed by gun and injured by gun at a higher rate than any other segment of the population. And we need to make safer our youth and make safer our African-American youth. The other concern raised, I think a good concern, is trafficking in illegal guns. And the state preemptions allow us to take additional actions that would impact positively illegal gun trafficking. But the statistics show that requiring reporting and requiring that serial numbers are included in the reporting significantly reduce the export of illegal guns from locales that have mandatory theft reporting of guns. For example, in the District of Columbia, the estimate is that there are 6.2 guns exported illegally out of the District of Columbia for every 100,000 members of the population. So 6.2 guns exported for every 100,000 residents of the state or the District of Columbia, compared to the 43 states that do not have mandatory gun theft reporting, which is 16.1 guns per 100,000 inhabitants. We need to make that kind of positive contribution to reduce the supply in gun trafficking. So we're seeking to make a positive impact on that, even if we can't do necessarily enact all the kinds of policy or legislation that we would want. And just a reminder that 4 out of 10 homicides in this city are committed by gun, and that on a national basis, the number of deaths of children by gun shows that almost half of the firearms used in unintentional or accidental shootings of children nationally were acquired by children from their parents. So while state preemption prevents us from doing maybe all we would like to do to support responsible gun ownership, we're doing what we can. And I also want to thank Warren Jimenez, who is my deputy chief of staff and has really led these efforts as we staffed up in the public safety peacekeeping arena. Thank you. Also want to thank Robin Springer, who filled in during that time, Antoinette Edwards and Kate Lieber, who have come on board since then. This has been a partnership effort. So Senator Jenny Burdick, Commissioner Judy Shiprack, Penny Akimoto, the executive director of Ceasefire Oregon, and the board there, Rob Ingram, Peter Ozan, Lipsick, and the Friday Gang Group, who have all had a contribution. Will this end up in court? Most certainly so. Will we fight it? Absolutely. What's at stake? The safety of our youth. Thank you. Aye. All right. Can you please read the companion resolution 1547 and call the vote?
Accept report to ensure effective coordination, oversight, community engagement, and measurable outcomes to prevent and reduce youth and gang violence.
Does anyone wish to testify on this matter? Please call the vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
We didn't talk too much about this 2 weeks ago, but it's the companion piece that from the local public safety coordinating council, which has recommendations and action steps to help reduce youth and gang violence in Multnomah County. And I believe the report is comprehensive and directs a well-thought-out coordination and oversight process. And the important part to me is that it not only involves law enforcement and governments, but also the communities that are impacted. Plus, it requires the development and implementation of measurable outcomes for all youth and gang violence reduction strategies in Multnomah County. So again, this is just a part of all of the strategies that are being pulled together to address this issue comprehensively. And I, again, appreciate the mayor's leadership on it. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Well, Commissioner Fritz is right to highlight the importance of this measure as well. The fact of the matter is we in the public sector and nonprofit sector, with the best of intentions, make it far too hard for someone that's seeking to turn away from a life of gun violence, to turn away from a life of violent crime. We make it too hard for them to do that. And so this requires us to do our part to make it much easier for anyone seeking to turn away from a life of violence to be able to do so and do so successfully. Individual responsibility for everyone's action is absolutely key, but so is our job of making it easier for those that want to change their lives and turn it around to be able to do so successfully. And we will do that by continuing to work on the comprehensive strategy outlined in 1547. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for 1548, which is a non-emergency first reading ordinance?
Allow Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to charge a fee to any party that, withstanding under Code Chapter 17.102, appeals BPS decision regarding solid waste or recycling to the Code Hearings Officer.
Hi. Welcome.
Morning.
Mayor Adams.
What are we looking at here? Council. I'm Bruce Walker, the Solid Waste and Recycling Program Manager for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We have two ordinances here today. The first one is to allow a fee for appeals of NER decisions. And quite simply, we have an extensive set of administrative rules to make sure our solid waste and recycling program works. Our goal in our customer service program is to resolve issues. And virtually all of those are resolved without getting into penalties and taking steps of more enforcement nature. A hauler not providing the right level of service, for example, or not remedying a problem. So occasionally, one of our findings or a penalty would be appealed to the Code's Hearings Officer, and there's a cost associated for that administratively, and like other bureaus in the city, the purpose of this proposal or this ordinance is to allow a fee to be charged for those who would appeal to the Code's Hearings Officer. I'll keep it at that. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to follow up.
Discussion from Council. Does anyone wish to testify on 1548?
No one signed up.
All right, this moves to a second reading next week. Can you please read the item for 1549?
Allow Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to charge fees to business and or property owners who apply for extreme economic hardship exemptions to the containers in the right-of-way rules.
What are we looking at here?
This ordinance,
for the record. Your name for
Bruce Walker.
I know you haven't changed, but it's
yes.
It's the rules. Sorry.
Yes. No. Thank you. I'm Bruce Walker. I'm the Solid Waste and Recycling Program Manager for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. This ordinance simply allows us to charge a fee for the administration of the containers in the right-of-way program if a business or property owner seeks an extreme economic hardship provision, if they're to submit an application. We are in the process and will be holding a public hearing to fully develop and finalize the rules for this sticky issue of the extreme economic hardship exemption. That will be held in early 2011. That public hearing that will finalize those rules. This ordinance simply addresses that, allows us to charge a fee, and we will align our rules with our hopeful passage by council on this proposal.
Questions from council? Does anyone wish?
I have a question.
Go for it.
We had
Is a hardship exemption meant to be or have a time limit to it, or it's subject to the rulemaking, whether it's in perpetuity or for a year, 2 years, 3 years?
That's a good question, Commissioner Salzman. Our proposal will have a firm time limit, and we're as we put this out for hearing, we'll have the draft rules out in the next week to 10 days, and it would have a one-year time limit on that. So
the present proposal
does, but
a one-year time limit on the exemption.
That is correct. However, we're going to go through a public hearing process to hear all sides, and we will finalize those rules. But as of now, that would be the proposal.
Okay, thanks.
So I'm not tracking this. Why are we doing this now rather than doing the rules first?
We held a rules hearing last year, and there were many questions that came up. So we are rewriting our administrative rules, and we'll hold a hearing. What the importance of this is to set that there will be a fee for, and we will align the rules, because right now there is not a specific fee associated with any application for extreme economic hardship. We believe that's an important step. We're requesting council approval of that, and with that approval, it would help set in motion our administrative rules and firm that up, that we would write everything in our rules to indicate that there would be a fee associated with this. We need council approval to charge a fee.
And are we going to see the administrative rules?
We will, yes. We will circulate those.
But we're not having a public hearing on those.
We will conduct the public hearing. The Bureau of Planning and Sustainability will conduct that public hearing.
So is this hearing the council's only opportunity to weigh in on the policy issue?
No. This today is not an attempt to address the containers in the right-of-way in a broad spectrum. The council's adopted policies before, and part of the issue is there was adoption by city council that there be an extreme economic hardship exemption process be established.
Right.
And it's given our Bureau direction to establish that process, and we do that through a public rules hearing. We will circulate those rules and discuss those beginning later this month, the circulation, in a public hearing early next year.
But I'm not going to have any opportunity after this to discuss the level of the fees or the principles involved in the administrative rules.
Is there any legal reason, Ben? Because sometimes we do administrative rules process to keep from something going unintentionally tripping from a fee to a tax. I'm fine with bringing back the proposed administrative rules for airing out with council, but I don't want to get hung up on anything.
When the council adopted policy regarding containers in the right-of-way, it specifically delegated to the Bureau the responsibility for developing administrative rules. If the council would now like to have those administrative rules presented in their final form after the public hearing process, because there is a rules adoption process that is set out in the code for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, if it would still like to have those rules presented to the council in a report form, that's up to the council.
I'm coming into this, even though I've been here nearly 2 years now, I think the previous rules were adopted before beginning of 2009, right? So I'm trying to figure this out. Thank you. That's very helpful. And thank you, Bruce. You've been extremely helpful both to me and constituents over the past 2 years in answering these questions. So I'm happy to go forward with the public testimony at this point. And it's not an emergency ordinance, right? So we can figure it out before the second reading. Thank you.
Any other discussion? All right. Anyone wish to testify
yes.
in this matter?
We have two people.
Great.
David Anderson and Michael Mills.
Hi, Mr. Anderson. Welcome back.
Thank you.
How are you? And Mr. Mills, come forward.
I'm reasonably well.
You're reasonably well. Are you fighting a cold like everyone else?
No.
Oh. Don't get too close to Commissioner Fritz, because she's got a cold.
Right.
Oh, I thought you had a cold.
No.
Okay. Just phlegmy.
Right. It's a shame your two colleagues can't join us. In any event, for the record, I'm Daniel Anderson. I reside at 2144 Northwest Flanders, Portland 97210. And because I live in a pre-war neighborhood, I contend with dumpster storage on the sidewalks on a daily basis. I was also a member of the council-appointed Crow work group on this topic a couple of years back. Now, item 1549 looks simple enough, just an ordinance to allow the folks at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to collect fees. But there's a bit more here than meets the eye, and I think you were sort of poking around at that reasonably effectively, Commissioner Fritz. First of all, the proposed level of fee is laughably low. At the end of the day, economic hardship is an economic analysis and an economic decision. Fees at this level will ensure that pursuing an exemption for the storage of dumpsters will almost always be more attractive than code compliance. It's kind of a get-out-of-jail-free card. You ought not be in the business of passing out those cards. Second, there's nothing in this item which places a time limit on exemption renewals. And in fact, the existing code allows exemptions to be renewed ad infinitum. You need to double back to that and correct that oversight. If there are to be exemptions from the general policy holding that dumpsters don't belong on our sidewalks, then the exemptions need to be short, of limited duration, and narrowly targeted to assist transition to compliance. Third, the staff transmittal memo, in its discussion of potential support and opposition, speculates airily about who may or may not support this. Curiously, the staff memo omits any kind of candid summary of the public testimony given at the sole public hearing conducted relative to exemptions. That hearing happened in November of 2009, prior to the last attempt by the Bureau to bring this fee to you. It was pulled from the agenda the morning it was scheduled to be heard. That was November 12, 2009. It turns out that at the public hearing, the testimony unanimously opposed exemptions and dumpsters on the sidewalk, and no testimony, written or oral, in any form was advanced in support of dumpsters on the sidewalk or any exemptions thereto. And to simply speculate in a rather unanchored way while failing to cover the actual substantive record ought to trouble you. It certainly troubles me. I, for one, reject that approach. These are of a piece. And I'd urge you to do, this is an issue with a very long history. As Mr. Mills will probably tell you, it's been the subject of multiple ombudsman's reports, one of which comments that the problem is on the order of a century old. You need to be a little more proactive about solving problems. So I'd urge you to do two things today. First, take no action on the proposed ordinance. Send it back to the Bureau to address concerns over the level of fees, the effective open-ended duration of exemptions, and the like. And second, I would encourage you to reaffirm from the dais today the city's commitment to getting all dumpsters, not just some dumpsters, off the sidewalks by a date certain, not more than a year from today. And thanks for your time and consideration today, and on behalf of all the citizens who've worked to get dumpsters off our sidewalks, thanks for your continuing commitment to make this an exemption-free reality sooner rather than later.
Thanks for your advocacy on this issue. Mr. Mills, welcome back.
Hi, I'm Michael Mills, Ombudsman for the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to make some brief comments today on this. I want to thank Dan as well for his years as a yeoman doing the public interest viewpoint on this issue through the Crow Committee. I want to thank Commissioner Saltzman and former Commissioner Francisconi for 5 or 6 years ago launching an effort to come to a resolution. And I want to thank the Bureau for the very difficult task that it's been to come to grips with how to deal with this last item, the extreme financial hardship waiver. And I think we're this close. We're just at the final tail end of this. And I appreciate the Bureau's rules and regulations that will place into effect a definitive time for the exemption, any exemption given to last. I think the final question that hasn't been answered yet here today that I am seeking the Council's direction on is to direct the Bureau in their rulemaking to make sure that is a finite time frame, that the date is set and it's not able to be renewed. Because we can issue an exemption for 1 year, that's a finite time frame. But if we allow it to be renewed indefinitely, then it will continue and continue. So I think what's needed, and City Attorney might be able to provide any other clarification, is just for Council to give their intent that they want a certain time for this to be completed and have these businesses come into compliance. So that's what I'm recommending. Thank you.
Is Thursday too soon?
Yeah.
Friday at the latest.
Thursday is too soon. Okay.
Well, I think when I was asking Bruce Walker the question about the duration of an exemption, I guess really it's really what you're hitting on. It's the ability to renew an exemption. And I think that's where we have to have a finite timeline, whether it's 1 year or some other period. But I do believe we have to give integrity to the notion we're going to get containers off of our sidewalks. We have to do that. So for what it's worth in terms of legislative history to the rulemakers, that's where I come down.
Is there any other advice to the rulemakers?
I agree that $250 is laughably low, as Mr. Anderson said, and that doesn't seem a lot of money. It would seem to me to be much more preferable to pay that fee every year rather than finding a place to put the dumpster elsewhere.
Any other comments from Council? All right. Thank you both. Coming up.
Again, I'm Bruce Walker from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. One of our jobs is to hear both sides of the story. We've received testimony. It was not unanimous at our public hearing. There was strong interest. This is a tough issue to solve on some of these crow containers in the right-of-way issues. We have worked closely. We've established new rules. Haulers cannot deliver containers that are set out in the right-of-way anymore. There are no new crow. So we are making substantial progress in resolving this issue. So the question becomes, how much should our proposal is to have an extensive application process of sharing financial records from a business that is in their terms, they'd be saying they're in extreme economic hardship. So we're trying to balance between, is $250 too low, or should we even require business to who's having economic problems to pay a fee? So we're trying to balance that. And then I just want to make it absolutely clear. Writing the check and submitting an application does not guarantee approval. So I'd request that you adopt the ordinance with the fees and allow us to conduct the hearing that would provide what I think will be rules that will address community needs, both of business community and the goal that we have to remove these containers from the right-of-way.
May I respond? I appreciate your point about the economic hardship, particularly right now, and so maybe there's some kind of graduated fee. It depends whether we're actually talking about leasing the right-of-way for permanent storage of these containers. And I'm currently discussing franchises, putting things in the right-of-way with the Office of Cable Communications and Franchise Management. There, we require companies to pay $2,000 to apply to put an antenna on a pole. And there are considerable rental fees for having or franchise fees for having for the use of the public right-of-way. So I think that needs to, as I said, I wasn't involved in the policy discussion that was adopted before I got on the council, but I do think that that needs to enter into your thinking at this time. If, in fact, we're renting space on a permanent basis, then $250 a year is not enough.
And I guess, respectfully, one thing I'd be interested in is, to the extent we have other hardship programs, what are the fee structures, and to what extent have we determined those are barriers? For example, Commissioner Leonard and the Water Bureau have a hardship program for people that can't afford to pay the water bill. I'm assuming we do not have a fee that effectively prevents people from exercising that hardship program. And so there is a balance here about whether a fee, which may be the fee necessary to commensurate to the privilege we're extending, in and of itself becomes a barrier to someone who is otherwise eligible from applying. And I don't know the answer to that, but we do have lots of other hardship programs in the city. So I would be interested in knowing where this fits in line with those. The other question I had is, to what extent does this particular issue intersect with food carts?
It doesn't particularly, because the sidewalk, the food carts are on, I'm just thinking out loud, because it's a different bureau. The food carts that are on private property, and most of them are, this doesn't impact them as long as they're not doing business on the sidewalk. Their customers can be on the sidewalk. Food carts that are on the sidewalk get permitted by us.
So, Mayor, I want to just flag this for your consideration. I, like probably everyone on council, big fan of food carts and have my favorites, but increasingly, food carts are all over the place. There are seating and tables and other things, including garbage receptacles, in the right of way on the sidewalk. There are structures being built adjacent to them, and there is storage in the back and the front. And I'm guessing this is a fairly new phenomenon, and therefore, the regulatory side is playing catch up. But my sense is that you're going to have some people who have food carts who might be seeking this hardship exemption, and I'm not entirely clear about what the rules are that apply to those small businesses.
We'll look at it. Thanks.
If I could just address the issue of the food carts, I too have had an increasing concern, which is not directly related, as you said, to this issue, but to respond to Commissioner Fish, to what appears to be improper, if not illegal, additions being added to the food carts. In meeting with the management of the Bureau of Development Services, they, because of the staff cutbacks, have not had the resources necessary to do the enforcement action they normally do, but I've asked them to reallocate resources to specifically address what I consider to be public safety hazards now with the additions of improper additions, illegal additions that you've identified as well, by taking enforcement action against those kinds of things that you've listed that you have observed with food carts. We're also working in the early stages of developing a code for food carts because they are growing and they do offer some competition to restaurants that have fixed costs that aren't necessarily associated with a food cart. So we're beginning the process of developing a code. Some cities, such as Seattle, have just taken the option of banning them. They don't allow them. We're trying to find a balance where they can be allowed, but done in a safe way and in a way that complies with health safety laws, fire code, and building code regulations.
If I may, just this is because I've noticed the proliferation of those structures, including overhangs,
yep,
and places where you can sit. And
those are generally illegal.
I assume so. Commissioner Leonard, if a landlord does a build-out in a building for a tenant and does a build-out, I believe the landlord is either primarily or secondarily liable on the building code issues.
That's right.
Even if the tenant improvement money is directed by the tenant.
Right.
Is there a way, because of the limited resources that your bureau has, to look to hold the property owner, the lessor, responsible?
Not only is that what is going to happen, I have met specifically with the primary property owner of those carts and told him it would be in his best interest to preemptively go to those food carts and have them brought up to code, or he would be liable in his company.
Thank you. What is
going to be coming rather soon.
So that, I think that's a useful discussion. Let's focus back on this.
Yes. I'm not going to be comfortable next week voting on this without more information and without more direction on what's going to happen with the rulemaking process.
Okay. Well, let's... I'd like to, if I could,
just specifically on this issue, to what extent is the regulation of the containers in the right of way, these rules being coordinated with Bureau of Development Services?
We've contacted the Bureau, but we're the until earlier this year, we had an interagency with BDS to follow up on the actual enforcement. We now have one of our staff do that work beginning this fiscal year, so that we go up, because we have the primary contact with the haulers, and we've done the follow up. But
even if it's reported as a nuisance,
well, it gets reported as a container that's out on the sidewalk typically. So if it comes through the nuisance, they would notify us because we're now the ones following up.
Okay. In the right of way, so it doesn't.
So I think I missed that change, because I get these kinds of complaints periodically, and then I forward them to our nuisance folks, but they end up forwarding them to you.
That's right.
So you guys then actually go out and look.
Yeah, we do on-site follow-up, and we've had significant progress in removing the containers. The remaining piece is this economic hardship.
So I guess I guess that leads me to the point of asking, and I'm sure if you folks are out there on the ground looking, is there truly no other place for these containers to be but the sidewalk, or are people looking for a more of a convenience by leaving them on the sidewalk and calling it a hardship? And I raise that issue not just as a matter of concern with the health and sanitation issues and the obstruction issues. These containers often become the sources of a discarded cigarette, or sometimes intentionally lit, and then we'll catch the building on fire. And actually, we've had a number of great alarm fires in Portland and high-rise occupancies that started in these kinds of containers that are accessible to the public on the sidewalk. So I guess I'm wondering how much we challenge the conclusion that a property owner reaches that they can't find any other place to put the garbage but on the sidewalk. Do we actually go in and look inside the building and ask why not there? Or if maybe you can't use a container, maybe you have to use a drop box, maybe you have to use a number of smaller containers that you then bring out to the sidewalk on garbage day, like homeowners do.
Those are exactly the steps we take when we work with a building owner.
Excellent.
And in many cases, we've been able to resolve these. But some owners, the city code says there shall be an economic hardship, extreme economic hardship process.
Mm-hmm.
Some business owners are aware of that, and they say to us, as soon as you get the rules adopted, we will apply for that because we can't resolve this issue. Until we have those rules in place, it becomes a lingering issue that I think has been pointed out here is causing concern in the community on some of these properties. So
I guess what I'm trying to identify is, and I appreciate your perspective, but there are other perspectives as well as to the hazards created by dumpsters accessible to the public that are there 24/7 that include public safety concerns. So beyond it possibly being inconvenient, it could also create a hazard to people in the building if it's left outside. So I'm just wondering if we agree with the property owner after we do our own eyes on check that there is absolutely no possible way, economic concerns notwithstanding, of storing garbage in the venue within which it's generated.
Well, the policy is that it shall not be allowed unless they've gone through this extreme economic hardship. So the businesses we've worked with, many of them have had difficulty. Some are transporting their garbage out in bags to an adjoining property owner. They've made an arrangement. In other words, many businesses have taken the right steps, and we've removed a large number of these. So the only way any business is going to have in the future to have these is if they go through this process. And we need to conduct a hearing to establish the rules to carry out that process. So in the future, I believe we are going to move to essentially container-free sidewalk of crow issues.
But except for those that apply and are granted some waiver based on an economic hardship.
Correct.
So I'm actually questioning the logic of that.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just going
to... And that is in city code right now, so we need to...
So
that would be the policy level that...
I appreciate that.
I just want to follow up. What's the definition of extreme economic hardship? Is
there
a number?
That's what they have to establish.
You're going to establish that. So then if the business becomes more prosperous, they come back for their annual renewal, they don't qualify for it anymore?
So can I jump in here? It's a great question. That's the whole purpose of the next step is to... Right now they've got protocols in place that they have to go out on-site. They determine whether or not structurally, economically, from a facility operations standpoint, sort of, is it possible structurally? Almost anything is if you have enough money. You know, what's an appropriate level of investment, those kinds of things. What they're doing now is they're going back and redefining those based on this early experience that has been less defined and needs to put more rigor to definitions of what is economic hardship and everything else. What I would suggest, and this is a 100-year issue for a reason, what I would suggest is that we make available to each of your offices individually before they go out for that hearing making so that they can, I would like some more numbers in terms of where'd we start, what have we done, you know, sort of different categories. So I've got a few additional questions prompted by this discussion. I'm happy to then have that individual direction and this direction from council, either bringing it back to council or then proceeding with administrative rules. Either way, once you sort of look at some of the additional details, if you decide to do administrative rules, I'm happy to air them back out with council. We do want to get this right. We do want to eliminate these obstructions, and I think your points around fire dangers are really important. We do want to do that, where we are trying to strike that balance. Does that make sense?
So I guess I'm just suggesting that. I'm not so much criticizing the rulemaking process as I am saying that our criteria should include some public safety concerns in addition to sanitation concerns.
That's a good point.
Or accessible concerns, access concerns along a sidewalk, or noxious odors concerns, which I get, or noxious streams of liquids, which I get complaints about emanating from these things. Those are legitimate concerns, but go to the livability and kind of health of an area. And I'm speaking to a narrower but potentially very important issue that would include public safety. So when we go to look at one of these sites, I think we should think of all of those typical things that one hears complaints about, but also the public safety concern of having them out on the sidewalk as a factor.
Commissioner Leonard? Yeah. Wait, I'm playing catch up and trying to understand this. It sounds to me like whatever policy is put in place would benefit from an automatic review process that goes to BDS and go to fire at a minimum, with a specified criteria of just determining whether there's a public safety issue that trumps even the consideration of economic hardship as just a routine matter.
Right.
So that if, as you said, proximity to a building, fire hazard, whatever, that gets some other eyes are on that, and then it comes back to BPS for the administrative side.
That's exactly, just much like we would do, you know, this isn't your shot, but just it sometimes helps to draw an analogy to point out the point. And if a building owner came and said, you know, I can't any longer afford to have this fire escape on the side of my building, and it's an economic hardship, what is the process I need to go through to have it removed? I mean, one set of eyes might agree, yes, it's going to cost you $50,000 to restore that fire escape. Another set of eyes would say, well, there's no conditions under which that you should be allowed to remove that. So I'm addressing this via that venue, and it's possible that maybe a checkoff with fire would be that necessary extra set of eyes and experiences that would allay the concern that I have.
And actually, since we started this 100 years ago, and I think Michael Mills, whose family, I think, wasn't one of your relatives mayor 100 years ago? So we can hold you accountable. He's from an old Portland family. But since we started just this most recent effort, then the laws around non-smoking have changed as well. So as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, I do see people hanging around dumpsters smoking. Why is that? And it's a new law. So I think that those are really important points. Let's make a round of individual council office discussions. We'll pull this back to my office since it's not an emergency and go from there. I think it's been a very good discussion.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks for your patience on this. Appreciate it. All right, unless there are objections, moves back to my office for further work. Can you please read the item, vacation of a street ordinance, item number 1550?
Vacate a portion of Southeast 21st Avenue north of Southeast Ochoco Street, subject to certain conditions and reservations.
Good day, Mayor, City Council. I'm Lance Lindahl from the Portland Bureau of Transportation, here today to answer any questions you may have about the proposed vacation of Southeast 21st Avenue north of Ochoco Street.
I haven't had a briefing on it, so you don't have pictures and a presentation?
I do have pictures I can share, yes.
Have you received any objections to this?
Have not received any objections with this. And very early on in the process, I was in direct contact with the president of the Selwood-Moreland Improvement League Neighborhood Association, and they were supportive of the proposal.
Are there any procedural problems with the application that you want to bring to our attention?
No, none at all. This one's been very straightforward, no controversy or opposition during the process at all.
It said that this in the record, though, it says there's no response from Selwood-Moreland or Southeast Uplift.
That's right. Early on in the process, which was 2 years ago now, I was in direct contact with Paul Naughty, the then president of the Neighborhood Association. Later on in our official notification process, we did not receive notification back, and that's what that reflects.
Thank you. And so this is the Springwater Trail to the
Yeah, it's actually upside down there. So this is south of the Springwater Corridor bike path.
So this is the Springwater. What's here?
It's all unimproved right-of-way, currently overgrown and impassable.
So wouldn't people want, and this why is there currently a house here?
There's a number of encroachments that were built by previous property owners in this area in the public right-of-way, and that was the reason for bringing the vacation proposal forward, was to legalize those.
How long ago?
The home was constructed in 1930, so 80 years ago. It's now used for commercial purposes. Playing catch up on this one.
I see. Well, I concur with Commissioner Fish's comment that there don't seem to be, haven't been any objections. I would like you, before we vote on it next week, to revise the findings regarding the comprehensive plan being met, as simply stating that it's been, that the comprehensive plan has been met doesn't meet that standard. But other than that, it would have been helpful to have had a briefing on this ahead of time, but I appreciate you having me.
You're welcome. I just want to add one other note, too, about the Springwater Corridor. This vacation stays. We're in contact with Metro, which owns the land that this portion of the Springwater Trail is on, and we were careful to craft the vacation so that it does not include area that they currently use for trail purposes. And the trail is elevated on an earthen berm in this area. It's about 20 feet higher than the vacation area. So it's literally impossible for users of that trail to access this portion of the right-of-way to get down to Ochoco Street.
So with it being, with the property, with the buildings being built in the right-of-way, how does the reversion